This Israel report is brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you are based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.
The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, Boker Tov, good morning. Hope you're well.
Boker Tov, yes. We're in for some stormy weather. We'll talk a little bit about
that
tomorrow.
I don't want
to preempt what's going to happen tomorrow. But we did get a message from Brian asking about Boaz Bismuth and the work that he's doing in the community to talk about or to consult about the Haredi draft law. And it's an interesting question, not because I think that the question is so significant, but it brings into some focus this guy, Boaz Bismuth, who's driving the Haredi draft law. He is the head of the Knesset Defense and Foreign Affairs Committee. And he has been nominated by the Prime Minister to replace Yuli Edelstein, who was previously responsible on behalf of the coalition for pushing the Haredi draft law forward. And it's interesting that this change took place because at some point, Yuli Edelstein was considered as being too amenable to being quite firm in insisting that Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox youth, do draft to the army according to certain parameters, rules, according to a certain process. And I think that Bismuth is considered to be a slightly softer touch, even more understanding towards the ultra-Orthodox side of the argument. And we really do have two sides on this argument right now. Side one says ultra-Orthodox youth should attend the army like everybody else. That's what the law says, and that's what everybody is required to do. And there seems to be no logical reason for exempting that particular community from the obligation to protect Israel and to serve in the army and to give some service to Israel in the same way that everybody else does. That's side number one. Side number two is the ultra-Orthodox community side, who argue on the one hand that learning in a yeshiva brings security to Israel via the connection to Judaism and via the learning and the respect that learning brings, learning the Torah and studying the Torah brings, and it brings a certain level of safety and security to the state of Israel. And of course, that was part of the pact that Ben-Gurion entered into with the Haredi community, with the ultra-Orthodox community many, many, many years ago. And interestingly, yesterday there was a protest again in Bnei Brak on route number 4. And even people were arrested for trying to knock over protesters who had blocked the roads. Now, that frustration comes not only because it's highly inconvenient in the rush hour to be held up by protesters who have gone onto a main arterial highway and blocked the road in order to bring their attention to the general public, but also because people don't believe that their cause is a just one, that people feel that they at some point need to recognize that they should serve the state of Israel like everybody else. Now, coming back to Boaz Bismuth, who is previously an editor of a newspaper, and he's also someone who served as Israel's ambassador to Mauritania. So he's a person who's been around, and he seems to be loved and trusted by the prime minister, and he's been nominated to see this through. And the objective of the prime minister here is to keep the ultra-Orthodox community, the ultra-Orthodox political parties, in the coalition. That is his main objective. And in order to achieve that objective, he needs to find a way to satisfy the ultra-Orthodox parties that the Haredi draft law gives them what they want. And what do they want? They want their youth not to go to the army. They feel some sort of a threat that their youth will go to the army and potentially come out of the army, no longer identifying with the Haredi community, with the ultra-Orthodox community. They will certainly not be converted to Islam or to Christianity. They won't come out non-Jewish, but there is a fear that they will come out non-ultra-Orthodox because of what they see in the army. And I think that this, at least the way that I'm reading things, is the biggest threat. So Boaz Bismuth is doing some sort of a consultation, but ultimately I think his objective is pretty clear. It is to keep the ultra-Orthodox parties in the coalition almost at any price.
So that is, Brian, I hope that answers the question, and certainly interesting for others as well. Anthony, we've also got a couple of questions about these yellow noose pins, but let's talk about other stuff, and if we have time we can come back to it, otherwise we can talk about it later in the week. The IDF attacked a Hezbollah training base facility in Lebanon overnight. So why was this attack carried out?
Well, it's interesting how the IDF are operating against Hezbollah in southern Lebanon right now, and how that's tying in with attempts to try to somehow strengthen the grip of the Lebanese government over Lebanon and over southern Lebanon in particular, which has been traditionally ruled by Hezbollah very, very tightly, and the Lebanese government has had very, very little say over what goes on in southern Lebanon. But now, with the in the aftermath of the war, where Israel's pager attack in particular was so effective, and, you know, of course, Israel's attack against the leaders of Hezbollah has been very much a weakening factor in the Hezbollah framework and the fabric of Hezbollah, that it seems an opportunity now for the Lebanese government to really jump in and take control over southern Lebanon. The problem is that Iran, in spite of the huge financial disaster that is going on in Iran right now, seems still to be flowing massive amounts of arms and money into Hezbollah and into southern Lebanon. And that's the reason why Israel continues to be very active over the last few days, weeks and months, and especially last night, in order to make sure that whatever work was done over the course of the last 2 years in the war that has been raged and in the weakening of Hezbollah is not lost now, while Iran is furiously trying to rearm Hezbollah and to reinforce their status in southern Lebanon. So this attack last night, interestingly, was carried out against a training facility that is being used by Hezbollah to apparently train their organization and for the planning of the execution of other terror plots against Israelis and against IDF forces controlling and patrolling along the northern border. And we understand that this training complex that was attacked was used for shooting exercises and for additional training in the use of various types of weapons. And also other military structures, such as a missile launch site, were also reportedly attacked in this particular event that took place last night. And in addition to that, we know that the IDF has also destroyed some tunnels that have been left behind by Hezbollah that are not currently in use, but which apparently still contain quite a lot of arms and weaponry. So in these tunnels that have been effectively abandoned as a result of Hezbollah being routed in that area, they've left behind equipment, and Israel has been attacking these tunnel shafts and the abandoned tunnels in order to destroy the mortar rounds and other weaponry that is that was still left behind in those tunnels and in those facilities. So Israel's job right now is really just to keep a watch on southern Lebanon and to make sure that there is no possible way that Hezbollah can really get back up on their feet and again assert their control over southern Lebanon. And effectively, even though the Lebanese government is not saying very much about this, and when they do say things, they are saying things that are critical of Israel, but effectively what Israel is doing right now is very much supporting and strengthening the control of the Lebanese government over Lebanon. And that's really what we want. How much more Israel will still need to do remains to be seen, but I guess there is still quite a lot more work to be done yet in order to achieve that objective.
Right. Let's talk about Kibbutz Be'eri. Members of the kibbutz have voted to demolish houses that were damaged and destroyed on October the 7th. I know that this was not a simple and obvious decision.
Very, very painful for the members of that kibbutz. Let's not forget how many people they've lost, how many people have been injured, how destroyed that kibbutz was on October the 7th. And now they are coming back to themselves, they are returning back to the kibbutz, and they are taking decisions about how to move forward. And the dilemma for the members of the kibbutz was a relatively simple dilemma. Do we leave those houses as they are, as a memory, as a commemoration to those people who were killed and were injured and were kidnapped? Do we leave it there as a reminder, or do we get rid of the houses and do we move on? And the vote in order to determine this future happened yesterday, and there was a split almost down the middle between members of the kibbutz. 196 members of the kibbutz supported the plan that was ultimately passed. 146 members of the kibbutz opposed it. That's how close the vote was. And in the end, the decision was, we are moving forward. We don't want those houses in our eyesight every day. We don't want to live in the past. And as one member of the kibbutz said, we don't want to live in Auschwitz. That was the comment that was made about the situation. So what have they decided to do? They've decided, first of all, to destroy those homes, to demolish them, those that were destroyed and that were damaged, except for one house, which is divided into two flats, will remain, will be stay there as a memory to all that happened, to everything, to all of those who were lost. Even though obviously that house belonged only to two families, but it will remain as a reminder to the events of October the 7th. We understand that that house will remain in the kibbutz possession for the next 2 years, at which point it'll be transferred over to some sort of a government authority that will manage the site as a memorial to all that happened on Kibbutz Be'eri during October the 7th and the period that followed that. And I think that that's a very admirable decision. I think that they are able to move forward. They are still preserving the memory in a limited sort of way. They don't want the whole kibbutz to be about what happened on October the 7th. They've got that corner, which will be a memorial, and the rest of the kibbutz is moving forward. And I salute that decision, and I admire those people who have been through such trauma and are now returning back to their home that they love so much and that went through such a lot of drama over the past 2 years to rebuild their lives. And I think we should all
100%.
do whatever we can to support them.
100% right. The Prime Minister has said that he will not resign in order to be granted a presidential pardon. What does this mean now, and in terms of obtaining a pardon?
Well, I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of President Herzog. And I'm thinking to myself, President Herzog, who, of course, is a very well-to-do lawyer. He was a partner in a law firm that was set up by his father many, many years ago and still has the family name. And so he knows legal ramifications and implications without necessarily having to be advised, although clearly he does have proper legal advice about this one. But the problem for him is, how does he stand up and grant the Prime Minister a pardon for a crime that he has not that he has not admitted to, and explain this to the people of Israel about why he's decided to grant the Prime Minister a pardon? Has the Prime Minister received special treatment under the law, or is this something that other citizens might expect to be able to get in the future? What has the Prime Minister given up? What has he acknowledged? What is he what is the price that he's had to pay for getting a pardon for a crime that has yet to be admitted to? And I think that by the Prime Minister, if the Prime Minister was willing to resign his office and to commit to not being part of the future political map of Israel, then the president would have some strength, some justification to stand up to the people and say he's agreed with the prime minister that he will step aside. In return for that, he will get a pardon. It all kind of seems justified. It seems as if there is a price being paid. The moment the prime minister says he's not willing to admit to the crime, he's not willing to step aside from his office, but he wants a pardon in spite of that, I think that it places the president in an extremely difficult position. And I'm very interested to see how the president is going to deal with this, because I think that if he stood up to the people of Israel today and said he's granted a pardon, even though the prime minister will stand in the next election, and even though the prime minister has not admitted to any crimes, I think that that would be almost an untenable decision. So I think that the prime minister, by saying that he won't resign, is effectively taking all of the tools that the president has away and effectively forcing him not to be able to grant this pardon. That's my interpretation.
And, Anthony, just to give a different perspective, and one that bothers me, is there's been a feeling and been a claim through many people throughout these trials that these trials were the even these allegations were really about ending his political career. If he has to accept the pardon in order to resign, isn't that what they would have wanted to achieve, if that is the case, in the first place? Therefore, I also understand that the Prime Minister, who's claimed this the whole way through, would say, well, why would I do that?
I agree. I mean, there is clearly a debate that goes on about the trials that the Prime Minister is facing and whether they are politically motivated and whether they are all designed just to try to trump up some minor activities that might have been infringements, but nothing more than that, to trump them up into something much more in order ultimately to end his political career. And so I agree that by being granted the pardon and having to resign, it would effectively achieve that objective. But I suppose the other question is, why is the Prime Minister requesting the pardon when he said that he will fight the case, that he's not guilty, that he doesn't, that he's able to fight it still while serving as Prime Minister, and then a change of heart? Where does that change of heart come from? Why has he requested this pardon? I think that that's also a valid question that needs to be answered.
That is where we leave it. 8:01, I'm Howard Feldman. That's all we have time for on the Israel Report this morning. You can catch Anthony tomorrow at 7:45.
That Israel Report was brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you're based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.